Well, this morning our text is Psalm 24, the Old Testament lesson. Psalm 24, we're doing a series of psalms for the remainder of the summer, and then, Lord willing, hopefully we'll start 1 Thessalonians in September. So Psalm 24, that's a song which has traditionally been sung on Ascension Sunday. You probably picked up the Ascension themes in the liturgy this morning. Though the Trinity hymnal places the psalm in with the Christmas songs, with the Advent season. And it is possible to read it that way, but I think the traditional association with the Ascension is better, and we will look at the text in that light this morning. I want to do something a little bit different here. I want to read the whole text as I think Israel would have read it in its original context, and then go back and reread the whole text in the light of Christ. Don't worry, that does not mean the sermon will be twice as long as usual. I mean, we'll stick to the time constraints. So let's ask what this might have looked like in its original setting. I think we have to picture a situation where all of Israel is ascending to Jerusalem to bring back the ark, as in 2 Samuel chapter 6 with David, or perhaps to celebrate its return in some kind of annual reenactment, right? Scholars call this psalm an entrance liturgy because it's about the entrance of the ark into Jerusalem. So that's what's going on. And all of Israel's ascending. At the top of the hill stands the city gates. And there's a priest or a group of priests standing guard at those gates. And the people move up en masse. And behind the people, there are priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant. Right, so that's the configuration the text assumes, right? Outside the priests, right? People, behind the people, more priests with the ark. The psalm then divides neatly into three portions. They're there on your outline on page 5. Royal creation, royal obedience, royal enthronement. So first then, royal creation. As they ascend, right, they're ascending up to Zion. Right, the people in unison say the opening verses of the psalm. The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. So they make a declaration that Yahweh is the royal creator, the king, and the Lord of all. And then in verse 3, we move to what we might call royal obedience. As a representative of the people, ask the priest guarding the gates, who may ascend the hill of the Lord, and who shall stand in his holy place? And then the priests guarding the city gates respond in verses 4 and 5. He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who doesn't lift up his soul to what is false, who doesn't swear deceitfully, he shall receive a blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. So it's a demand, right, for faithful Torah living, for purity inside and out, hands and heart. And in the event of sin, right, if you offered the right sacrifices, you could be cleansed and declared pure again, and thus fit to ascend and stand in the holy place. So in verse 6, the people reply to the priest that they are fit for worship. They say, such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek the face of the God of Jacob. So they declare that they've offered the royal creator the obedience necessary. And then the people in the ark would then be about to enter the royal city and ascend to the hill of the Lord. But before they do, right, and here we move to royal enthronement, before they do, there's a sort of liturgical pause for dramatic effect. The priests behind the people bearing the ark, and thus the very presence of the Lord, they shout out in verse 7, lift up your heads, O gates, and be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory might come in. Meaning, open the city gates so the ark of the divine presence might be enthroned in Zion. And then for dramatic liturgical effect, the priests who are guarding the gates, they say, this is verse 8, who is this King of glory? And of course, this is not a question about the identity of the king enthroned in the ark. Again, it's a liturgical delay to the entrance so that Yahweh's glory might be proclaimed. And so the ark bearers reply. They say, "The Lord, strong and mighty, the Lord, mighty in battle." And so they repeat the demand to enter. Verse 9, "Lift up your heads, O gates, be lifted up, O ancient doors, that the King of glory might come in." And then in verse 10, the gate-guarding priests repeat the question. Who is this King of glory? And finally, the ark-bearers reply, "He is the Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory." And at that point, the psalm ends, and the ark is restored to the city, and eventually to the tabernacle and the temple. So you have royal creation, royal obedience by the people, and royal enthronement of God's presence on the hill. Something like that is how this psalm works in Israel's ancient liturgical life. So now I want to look more closely at the text and giving special attention as to how we read the Old Testament, and particularly this text, in the light of Christ. So royal creation in verse 1, right? Verse 1 says, "The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein." It's a statement of the sovereign kingly authority of God above all things. The earth is His. All of its fullness, its wealth, its fertility, its fruitfulness. Not only the physical creation, but all the peoples of the world, those who dwell therein. They are all the possession of our God, of the sovereign Creator. And this divine rule is established because we're told in verse 2, "The Lord has founded the earth upon the seas and established it on the rivers." It's a bit of an odd turn of phrase, but it's a reference to Genesis 1, where in the beginning God shaped the formless watery void, right, into the waters above, and the waters below the firmament, and then He caused the waters below the firmament to gather into seas, and He made the dry land appear. That's what the reference is to. And of course, we've said many times here that seas in the world of the Bible often stand for chaos or evil powers. For example, Isaiah 57, verse 20 says this, "The wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, and its waters cast up mire and dirt." So the idea here, right, that God founded the world upon the sea, upon the waters, carries the idea of God's lordship over chaos and over all the powers. Now, we in the West take this for granted because we've had this doctrine of creation for thousands of years. But in the religion of Baal, for example, right, if you go back to this ancient Near Eastern culture that Israel was in the religion of Baal, who was one of the chief rivals to Yahweh, right? Baal has to overcome the seas and the rivers, which are viewed as hostile forces, in order to create the world. Right? Creation is violent. It involves conflict. The text here is saying that Yahweh is sovereign over all, and He's not threatened, and that His word alone effortlessly secures the creation. There's no violence at the origin of the cosmos. There's just the sovereign, serene, peaceable, efficacious word of Yahweh. It's radically different than all the religions around Israel, as passé as it might sound to us. So this creation is royal creation. But we must remember that Jesus Christ, the Word, right, the Logos, the Word of the Father, is the one through whom all things were made. Creation has about it a sort of sun-centricness, sun-centric nature. The early church wrestled, right, for decades to confirm that Jesus Christ stands on the Creator side, wholly, of the creator-creature divide, and that through Him, everything that was made came to be made. So in this Creator Christ, by whom all things were made, as we say in the Creed, is the one who will overcome the evil powers in the fallen creation and restore the order of things in the new creation. And he'll do that, of course, by his royal obedience. Now, if you think back, at the end of the first creation, what happened? Well, what happened was Yahweh entered his Sabbath rest. Right? The royal creator was royally enthroned so that the whole cosmos would be a temple to God's glory. And the temple in Jerusalem, right, which comes into view here in this psalm in verse 3, right, speaks of the holy hill, that's Zion. Right? That's a microcosm of the world. So think of the world just by virtue of its creation as Yahweh's temple throne. But after the fall, this gets worked out by establishing a temple in the midst of his people Israel and dwelling in that temple in the ark, which is sort of God's portable throne, his earthly throne. The point is this: the appropriate and proper response to creation is worship. The worship of the triune God. Creation, then Sabbath rest, worship. And so we move in the psalm in verse 3, and all of these questions, right, about who may ascend and who may stand in the Lord's holy place, these are questions about how do we get in a fallen world from royal creation, how do we get the royal obedience needed to be true worshipers? How do we get to the Sabbath rest? How do we get to the worship? So if you look in the psalm in verses 3 through 6, it's setting forth the ethical qualities, the righteousness needed by true worshipers. And of course, all of this is fulfilled in the obedience of Jesus Christ. There are two things to notice here about Christ's fulfillment of these verses. Again, verses 3 through 6. First, Jesus Christ alone is the one who without blemish has clean hands and a pure heart, and who never lifted up his soul to falsehood, who never swore deceitfully. Right? Jesus rendered what our confessions call perfect, personal, exact, and entire obedience for us. He's the only one who can answer these questions in verses 3 through 6 in the affirmative, who can lift up his hand and say, me. And second, because the creation has fallen and is disordered, his royal obedience culminates in that bloody cross by which he procures entrance into the holy place for himself and for his people. Right? Because of his obedience, he receives the blessing of God in verse 5. And the word for righteousness in verse 5 means vindicated. Jesus publicly vindicated in his resurrection from the dead. And thus he ascends to the true Zion, the true tabernacle made without hands, and his ascension is his royal enthronement. He who is the royal creator offers royal obedience and ascends and is royally enthroned, all for your sake. He ascended into heaven and is seated, that's regal splendor, at the right hand of the Father. And so, hopefully now we can see at least a little bit of the wisdom of the churches historically associating this psalm with the ascension. Again, simply to summarize it, here's the whole sermon. Christ, the royal creator, offers royal obedience and is in his ascension royally enthroned. So his ascension then is not an afterthought. It's integral to Christ's priestly work. Right? His work as priest is really just begun at Calvary. It's certainly not ended. He is currently doing priestly ministry on your behalf. Remember the Old Testament liturgy of atonement, the Day of Atonement, Leviticus 16. The high priest and the high priest alone takes blood, the sacrificial blood, and enters the most holy place and sprinkles that blood on the mercy seat in the very presence of Yahweh, the holy and transcendent Lord. It's not enough, actually, to offer just the sacrifice. The blood of the sacrifice must be taken into the holy place and sprinkled there. And so Jesus, after offering his blood in royal obedience, ascends, presents himself and his own blood, not the blood of bulls and beasts, but he presents that blood, his own, in the heavenly tabernacle. Right? That was in Hebrews chapter 9, which was the New Testament lesson. So the earthly types and shadows give way here to the heavenly reality. This is why we simply cannot go back and drop ourselves into ancient Israel and read the text as if we were Jews from 3,000 years ago. In so doing, Jesus makes a way for us to ascend the hill of the Lord, which is now the heavenly Zion, and to do so with clean hands and a pure heart. Right? He sprinkles that blood on you and he cleanses our souls of falsehood and of deceitful swearing and of all of our oath breaking and of all of our violations of our baptismal vows. It's only because of this that we can pray and we can worship. And he holds his priesthood perpetually and permanently in heaven, and we are utterly dependent on it. This is the Christian logic of the psalm. So, in closing, I want to look just a little bit more closely at Christ's royal enthronement, his ascension, and this is in verses 7 through 10. So we read it now, verse 7. We see it as a cry to open the gates of heaven, right? Not the gates of the earthly Jerusalem or Zion, heaven. I call this verticality, vertical, right? We don't just read the Old Testament like this and slide it into the New Testament and replace Israel with the church, right? What happens in Christ is there's this vertical action. He's raised, he's ascended, he enters the heavenly Zion. Everything that's in the land is transposed into a heavenly vertical key. And this verticality is essential if we are to be Christian people who breathe the air of heaven and the age to come. So this text is about a Zion that is no longer located on earth, because all of the reality is in the land. Right? Where's the temple now? It's in heaven. Where's the priesthood now? It's in heaven. Where's the Davidic throne now? It's in heaven. Where's Zion now? It's in heaven. Where's Jerusalem? It's the Jerusalem from above. The whole thing is transposed into this kind of a key. But we have an ability to flatten these things out, right? We read this as if we can just say, oh, this is all fulfilled in Jesus, but it all stays horizontal. But that's not what's happened. Verse 7 is a cry to open the gates of heaven. The phrase ancient doors is rendered in some translations everlasting doors. You saw that in the psalm we sang. So thus, unlike the city gates, these gates are open. They remain open. For the kingdom of Christ is an everlasting, enduring kingdom. As the creed puts it, after speaking of his ascension, his kingdom shall have no end. Its gates are never shut. And Christ is depicted for us here in verses 7 through 10, not in his lowly, humble state of obedience, but in his state of exaltation. He is called the King of Glory 5 times in this section. This is another reason that the ascension and his exaltation is more fitting than the incarnation and his humiliation for this psalm. The Christ who enters as the King of Glory is said to be, in verse 8, the Lord, Yahweh incarnate in your flesh. But again, he's not simply Lord here. The text says he's Lord strong and mighty, mighty in battle. He is, as verse 10 puts it, the Lord of hosts, the Lord of the armies of heaven and the earth, the Lord adored now by the heavenly host, by the whole court of angels, the servants, the burning attendants of the king. So the Christ here is the king who returns triumphant after his bloody warfare. Christ enters heaven as the Lord of battle with his own blood, wearing the humanity that has the very scars that Thomas stuck his hand into. Think of this, right? Pastor Vance used to always say this: there is a man at the right hand of God. a scarred and glorified man, the ascended Lord of glory, the King of Psalm 24, the one who's been royally enthroned, the one who royally created all things, and the one who by his royal obedience reconciles all things. So that now, we say, all created things, visible and invisible, all powers, all authority are placed under his ascended rule. We don't yet see this, the book of Hebrews tells us, but we do see Jesus exalted at the right hand of God. His dominion now is as wide as the scope of his creation. And this is why we and the whole creation are now summoned to worship. Right? And at the end, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, the Lord of hosts, the Lord of battle, to the glory of God the Father. The glory of the church, or maybe better, the glory of this text for us, is that now, right, this becomes concrete for us in our corporate worship. Because we are when we come here to worship, what is happening, a lot of things are happening, but the central spine of what's happening is that we are being taken up in and with and through this warrior king and his blood into the highest heavens and presented righteous before the face, the blazing splendor of the triune God, who we now call Father. And we ascend in him and we worship. It makes heavenly worship possible. Right, we speak all the time here about Jesus taking our defective obedience and our defective prayers and our defective praise and our wandering thoughts and our inadequate worship and our, you know, tepid prayers and all of that and gathering it up through his own ascended self and presenting it and us in him before the face of the Father. Otherwise, worship would be a chore. Right? It would just be a litany of all of our failures. We are made clean, and we are made pure. Or maybe put more provocatively, Jesus has fulfilled the beatitude, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God, so that you might be pure in heart and gaze upon the face of God. That's what's happening. We ascend, and we echo the ark-bearing priests, and we sing to the King of Glory, the Lord of Battle, our Savior, our ascended High Priest, Jesus Christ. Praise be to God, the royal Creator, for his royal obedience and for his royal enthronement. All glory be to Christ, the ascended King. Amen.